Done this before?
I'm going to open the meeting for the Ag and Natural Resources for March 21st, and welcome, and thank you for being with us today. And today we are going to be having a public hearing, and we are going to be starting on this public hearing on House Bill 2438. And I would like to just make a couple of comments, and then I'm going to turn to Laura and have her let us know a little bit more about the amendments that should be there for you. First of all, as you know, the Wetland Regulation Work Group actually worked on bills for about 8 months, and there were three different concepts that came out of all of those work groups. And these three bills resulted in House Bill 2436, which is the 404 partial assumption bill, which we heard this last Tuesday. House Bill 2437, which is the dry ag channel maintenance bill, which was heard earlier in the session. And then this bill, which is House Bill 2438. And it's going to be a bill that we're going to have the public hearing on today. And it's a little bit of a bill that is sort of a catch-all bill. And it has topics that relate to wetland mitigation, and also it relates to wetland mapping. And I want to tell you just a little bit about the wetland mitigation, because that's a very large topic. And we discussed that the problem was that the cost of mitigation credits is both high and variable, and that the work group felt that the cost between $75,000 per acre to $250,000 per acre to mitigate for the wetlands, which can be really a very large hurdle for affordable housing and other development projects, was particularly apparent in the rural communities. The group investigated what was driving those costs and what can be done to bring those costs down. Some of the amendments open the door for more public role to help fill the gaps where we don't have enough mitigation banks, and to help increase what we would call competition. And particularly, they were excited about the opportunity for us to possibly do a pilot project. And we actually have a Cascades West Regional Consortium that has some experience with this, and would be an example of someone that might be able to do this pilot program for building their own mitigation bank. So that's the mitigation part of it. The second part is the wetland mapping. And from the very first meeting, way back when, I don't remember, May or June or something like that, there was a very large discussion about the maps, about the updating of maps, about which maps really were lacking in some ways, which maps did not concern certain elements of looking at wetlands. And they just wanted to talk a little bit more about mapping. This issue was an issue that was back in 2017, was also something that was worked on. And the law requires DSL to keep a statewide wetland inventory to update it, and they're supposed to update it periodically. And DSL has added some new soil layers that show areas that are likely to contain wetlands. Cities and counties have had to consult this map and to get their projects approved. So the map update should reduce the likelihood that the cities and counties unknowingly make a mistake and approve projects that are actually with wetlands on them. The work group expects cities and counties will be notifying DSL more about possible wetlands because of this expanded mapped area. So those are kind of the background subjects that this particular bill was built from. And I'm going to actually turn to Laura now to talk to you about the amendments, where they are and what they are, so that you'll understand what's in front of us for the public hearing today. They're a little wonky, and so we felt like it was important to give a little background.
Chair McLean, members of the committee, there is a -2, a -3, and a -4 amendment on OLIS. The -2 is a policy piece that would eliminate certain restrictions on the purchase of credits from the Oregon Removal Fill Mitigation Fund. And it specifically specifies that credits may be purchased from that fund when there are other mitigation bank credits also available in the same region. The dash three was just added to OLIS probably 30 minutes ago, members, and it's the lengthiest of the bunch. So I think you will hear from some stakeholders describing it in more detail, but in essence, it establishes an Oregon Mitigation Bank Corporation, and it specifies the terms of that, the board of that, the functions of that, et cetera. So you'll hear more about that. And then the dash four is an appropriation from the general fund for two different purposes. One is an appropriation to the Oregon Cascades West Council of Governments, which Representative McLean just mentioned, to be used in a pilot program to hire employees and solicit bids and contract as needed to identify the compensatory mitigation needs and opportunities in the region that they serve. And also to develop a business model and strategic plan for how to address those needs through the development of their own public mitigation bank for that region. And the second purpose for the appropriation is for money from the general fund to DSL for providing responses to the expected increase in wetland land use notices. And that's it.
So at this time, what we would like to do is call up Panel one, which we have Eric Mitz, DSL, Dave Honeycutt from the Oregon Property Owners Association, and Ellen Miller from the Oregon Home Builders Association. Welcome. Please give your name for the record, and we'll start with Eric.
Good afternoon. Vice Chairs McLean and Post, and members of the committee. I'm Eric Metz, Senior Policy and Legislative Analyst for the Department of State Lands, and I'm here to talk today about compensatory mitigation generally, to give you kind of the background and framework for it. So the context is Oregon currently has approximately 1.4 million acres of wetlands, over 100,000 miles of rivers and streams, 1,400 named lakes, and 360 miles of coastline, an additional 3,800 ponds and reservoirs. Although Oregon's wetlands comprise only about 2% of the state's land base, these state wetland ecosystems have many functions that provide numerous benefits to the environment and to people, including flood control, protection of drinking water, habitat for fish and wildlife, and recreation. Historically, Oregon's experienced a reduction of about 1 million acres of waters and wetlands due to agricultural and urban development. And in 1967, the legislature recognized that protection and conservation, best use of these waters, was vital to the economy and well-being of the state. And the primary state law that currently authorizes regulation activities is the removal fill law. In addition, Oregon has set a no net loss policy as a goal, and we're required to maintain a stable resource base of wetlands to encourage wetland restoration and creation and to offset losses of functions and values of water to the state. And then in 1989, the Department of State Lands wetland program was established by statute through a comprehensive wetland conservation bill. And today, DSL's Aquatic Resource Management Program is responsible for issuing removal fill permits, developing and maintaining the statewide inventory, which you mentioned earlier, Representative McLean, providing wetland planning assistance, which is also a part of that, to applicants and local governments, developing wetland protection standards, functions and value assessment tools, and providing public information and training for identifying potential wetland areas. Though there has been a decrease in the rate of wetland loss, ongoing development and land use activities threaten and degrade wetland resources. Our concern about this trend is that when we lose wetlands, we lose functions they perform and values they provide, including flood control, protection of drinking water, and habitat for fish and wildlife and recreation. So in order to respond to the cumulative loss of wetlands in the state of Oregon, we have this no net loss goal. Concept is no net loss does not preclude developing wetlands and projects that require removal fill. Rather, that's where compensatory mitigation comes in, because it's required to replace those lost functions and values in order to prevent wetland loss. So what is compensatory mitigation? It's a sequenced approach. It's really an approach seeks to avoid any impact to aquatic resources and then to minimize the magnitude of the impacts and finally to repair, restore impacted areas when the project is complete, and finally to compensate for any unavoidable losses. So there's four basic steps. First one is to assess functions and values of the proposed mitigation area so we know what's being lost. Second, identify places where mitigation can be performed, which are referred to as mitigation sites, to best offset the impacts and develop a mitigation plan for the permit application using those same function and value assessment tools. Then the compensatory mitigation is carried out, and finally it's monitored for success. And there's three ways to accomplish this. One way, applicant can purchase credits from an approved bank or an in-lieu fee project if available. Permittee responsible mitigation, where the applicant builds a mitigation on the project site or elsewhere within the watershed, is another option, although that tends to be a little more expensive for applicants or tend to shy away from that if there are bank credits available. Payment in lieu mitigation, when no bank or in-lieu fee credits are available and when the applicant cannot identify a suitable mitigation project, can be accepted by the department, but the Corps won't accept those because they're not tied to specific watersheds. So how does compensatory mitigation serve as a tool for balancing competing state objectives of resource protection and development? Although all wetlands share the same basic features, or ecological functions and ecosystem services differ between regions and between landscapes. Oregon's wetlands and ecosystems are highly diverse. They reflect robust physical and biological resilience in the state. To achieve the state's goal for maintaining a stable resource base and healthy ecosystems, we coordinate with local governments and land use planners who use local wetland inventories to determine when coordination with DSL is necessary through sending us local wetland land use notices. DSL reviews and responds to these notices to provide planners and applicants with information about the likelihood that wetlands might be in the project area. That's subject to confirmation, of course, by DSL. It alerts landowners and developers to a possible need for delineation, and we're required to respond within 30 days. The appropriation part of the bill will ensure DSL continues to provide high-quality service even after the department releases the new online state wetland inventory, which will affect workloads. The position will also increase DSL capacity for on-site visits, which are very important. You can't tell everything from maps. Site visits can reduce the need for costly delineation, speed up timelines. The coordination helps prevent inadvertently developing in wetlands, helps avoid impacts, helps prevent project delays. Coordination between DSL, the applicants, and the land use planners is critical to ensure there's a balance between the state's no net loss goal and development. So in closing, thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. I'm happy to take any questions. Also want to point out that our policy and planning manager, Gina Hicks, is here, who's an expert in mitigation, if you'd like to address any questions to her. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Shall we wait for questions till the end of the panel? Okay. So let's go on, please, to Dave Honeycutt.
Thank you, Chair McLean, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Property Owners Association, here in support of all of the various amendments. I haven't seen the dash threes yet, as Laura indicated. They're hot off the press, but I have an idea of what's in them. The three of the recommendations that the subgroup made to the full group, and so I know I will support them. I'm going to talk a little bit, really focus my comments on the dash twos, because the problem that we've discovered, one of the issues, and you're going to hear in the next bill from someone who is having this particular problem, in the smaller Willamette Valley cities, we have all kinds of problems with number one, a lack of mitigation banks. And as we continue to update our maps, I guess a growing recognition that a lot of the land that's inside the urban growth boundary that's zoned and under our land use system is supposed to be available for urban development is in all likelihood falls within the definition of wetland under both state and federal law. That's a problem when you go to develop that property and discover that you have to, in order to do the development, you need to do some mitigation work, and the offsite mitigation work that you need to do because you are essentially disturbing wetlands, and you want to go to do the offsite mitigation work, and you find that there may be only one mitigation bank in that serves that watershed, and that one mitigation bank is charging fees per acre that you have to purchase in order to fill the wetlands on the site that you're developing, and the cost to purchase those credits is so high that it essentially makes the project fail to pencil out. So where we've been concerned about this is the essentially from the disconnect between land use planning and the whole idea that that lands in the urban growth boundary are supposed to be available for urban development, coupled with the fact that a number of the cities when they did their buildable lands inventories brought their land inside the boundaries because of a lack of knowledge, didn't understand that the bulk of the land around within their buildable land inventory consists of hydric soils and thereby is probably considered wetland. And so we've got if we can't do offsite mitigation at a reasonable rate, then the development that you would expect that these small Willamette Valley cities need can't happen because the projects end up not penciling out. So one of the things that we did in our work group is we brought in some mitigation bankers. There are a few of them, and we asked them, okay, why aren't there more mitigation banks so that essentially there's more competition, so that instead of having to pay $70,000 an acre to do offsite mitigation for this project, there are four or five mitigation banks, and I can go and that from the developer's perspective and say, okay, they're charging 70, we'll pay you 50 or whatever, and get the competition so that we can get the prices low enough that we can purchase the offsite mitigation credits and make the projects pencil out. And what we found from the private mitigation bankers is, number one, there is not a lending institution, at least it may be a small local bank, but there aren't very many lending institutions that want to lend on these projects. There's uncertainty about whether or not you qualify. There's uncertainty about the timing of when you can pay back the loan. You go in and say, okay, you go into Wells Fargo, and I'm not picking on Wells Fargo, but you walk into Wells Fargo and say, okay, I need to borrow $2 million because I want to create a mitigation bank and sell the mitigation credits to developers as they go to develop projects within the watershed. And Wells Fargo says, okay, well, when are you going to be able to repay the mitigation, pay the loan? And you say, as soon as I can sell the mitigation credits, and I don't really have any idea when that's going to occur, and I don't know exactly what is going to be required in order for me to get approval from DSL to open as a mitigation bank. And Wells Fargo looks at you and says, well, we've got plenty of other places to loan our money rather than to loan it to you. And so we found that basically the private sector can't do what it is that we need to do in order to create enough mitigation banks to get the credit prices low enough so that we can go in and actually develop in some of these small Willamette Valley cities. The Dash 2s help fix that problem by essentially allowing the state to go in And so you can hopefully generate some competition, lower the credit prices, and enable us to do the development that the land use system says that we're supposed to do, and that these small Willamette Valley cities are asking for. You heard Mr. Latta, I think is going to testify today from Harrisburg at the last meeting, talking about some of the problems that Harrisburg has been having developing within their urban growth boundary. The next bill that's on the agenda today, Madam Chair, from Sheridan, you'll hear the exact same thing from Sheridan. And so it's a real problem. And what anything that we can do with these bills to help fix that, we ought to support, because it does a better job of balancing the legitimate needs of wetland protection and also the legitimate needs to provide needed housing within urban growth boundaries in some of these smaller Willamette Valley cities.
Thank you very much. Ellen.
Good afternoon. Excuse me, Chair McLean, Vice Chair Post, members of the committee. Ellen Miller here on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association. I assure you this is the last day I will be in front of you. You no longer need to worry that I am going to go into labor up here at the dais. We are here in support of the -2 and the -4 amendments to House Bill 2438. Mr. Honeycutt really hit all the high points that I had in my testimony, so I don't want to be too duplicative, but really, we support eliminating the non-compete clause for the mitigation banks for all the reasons that he said. Not enough are being built, not enough credits available, which drives up the cost of mitigation and development. You know, that it's very speculative for the mitigation banks as far as doing a deal that the repay period and rate of return is unknown. We really feel that opening this up to state or public banks will really bring the patient capital that's needed to do this work. So with that, I just thank you for the opportunity to be in front of you this session. It's been short and sweet, and I'll look forward to seeing you all when I come back.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for our panel?
Yes.
Yes, please, Representative Post.
Chair McLean, I'm sorry, but Ellen, I have to say, I hope everything goes great. And when are we thinking, maybe, or hoping?
Chair McLean, Vice Chair Post. Saturday is my day.
All right. This Saturday?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
There, we got that one.
On the record.
Yeah. So, any other questions for our first panelists? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Our second panel, this is on the Public Mitigation Bank Pilot Program, and this is a -4 amendment. And we have Pat Hare and Brian Latta and Phil, and it's Warnock. Pat, would you like to start?
Phil was going to start with...
Oh, that's fine. You guys arrange yourself.
Thank you, Vice Chair McLean and Post, members of the committee. I'm Phil Warnock. I am with Cascades West Council of Governments and staff to the Cascades West Regional Consortium. I'm here to testify on behalf of Council of Governments and on HB 2438, specifically -4, which concerns the opportunity to prototype a regional model to address compensatory mitigation needs. Oregon Cascades West Council of Governments is a voluntary association of the counties, cities, towns, tribes, and ports of Linn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. Our 25 members working together identify regional needs, prioritize strategies, and build frameworks to make our region and its jurisdictions stronger, our economy thrive, and our environment secure. The Council of Governments has a long history of delivering large-scale programs and projects. We are a federally designated economic development district. We provide business lending programs through Small Business Administration loans, USDA and EDA funded programs. We coordinate transportation planning through two metropolitan planning organizations and an area commission on transportation. And we coordinate brownfields planning on behalf of city, county, and tribe partners through an Environmental Protection Agency grant, among many other programs at our agency. At the request of our members, the Council of Governments has been working on wetland issues for over a decade now. Out of these efforts, we established the Cascades West Regional Consortium, which is a 501c3 nonprofit, which its mission is to address community and economic development opportunities and barriers while concurrently working for environmental and social good in the COG region. So why a regionally scaled compensatory mitigation bank? Market forces have caused wetland mitigation credits to have high and variable costs and uncertain availability, as has been mentioned by the previous panel. Development of vacant land in Oregon is stifled by wetland constraints and insufficient mitigation options, adversely affecting industry and housing sectors and rural communities. Oregon is in a housing availability and affordability crisis. Primary constraints include the price of land, number of shovel-ready lots, and the availability of financing given the uncertain timing and cost of wetland mitigation. The Willamette Valley contains a high proportion of wetland development constraints and serves as a proxy for demonstrating regional solutions to address wetland issues. The legislature, in creating this proposal, or this proposed wetland mitigation bank prototype program, will provide for a county-city partnership to build their own mitigation bank on publicly owned land. Why do our communities want a local public bank? The prototype will address the rising cost of wetland bank credits, increase supply of credits available for development, test the marketplace for replication in other regions of the state, and establish administrative capacity for public sector development of wetland mitigation banks across the state. It is therefore in the public interest, we believe, to explore this pathway in the region served by Cascades West Regional Regional Consortium that will support the development of a mitigation bank on publicly owned land through a regional partnership. Council of Governments supports HB 2438-4 because it is timely, innovative, and proactive in creating a prototype for addressing the need for compensatory mitigation credits into the future. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vice Chairs McLean and Post and Committee. I think Phil did a good job describing who we are. Now, my name is Pat Hare, though, and I am the chair of the Cascades West Regional Consortium. I also sat on the subgroup. I also am the city manager of Adair Village. And I'm also the predecessor to this project of my father, Wes Hare, who was the city manager of Albany. So I've been involved in this for a long time. And so I guess the question also would be is why is our consortium the best fit for this pilot program? And I have some simple answers to that. I know we are. We've already done this. We've already built this plan. We've already done this back in 2010. Our cities came together and built a collaboration and did this type of study. We know that a public sector can do this cheaper. We have public lands. We don't have to buy during when the market is high, which is what is happening. The demand for credits comes when there's a demand for growth. And so then farmland is more expensive. We can do that in different times. We don't have to do it when the demand's there, but we can have the supply ready when the demand's there. So that's a fundamental difference. The other thing that our consortium has completed and accomplished is we were the only group, and DSL can vouch for us, is that went through the AARP, the Advanced Aquatic Resource Plan, and not only did we get one site approved, we got 19 industrial sites approved through that process. And that process is a very intense process. It protects our wetlands way more than if you're just going through a regular application process. And so we feel that Cascades West is set up in a unique position as well, where we're made up of 25 organizations. If you were giving this pilot program to one individual entity, you know, they might not be able to follow through. Heads change, people change, but this group hasn't. We started in 2006, and yes, there's different city managers, and like I said, my father was one of them before me. But we have that continuity that you need for this type of pilot program. And so we also have a model and a business plan as well that we can really just build on and update. And we have that, it was completed. We had all of the comparisons to the different wetland banks that currently exist. We had the sites that we could develop. So we have a lot of this information already completed. And then we have our AARPs that also are 19 industrial sites that are very detailed about what those wetlands are and what their needs are. So we can already use that information to know where we can develop wetlands. So we feel we're in a very good position. So we support two and four, because you can't really do four without two. So we support both of those. So that's where we're at. Thank you very much for letting me speak today.
Vice Chairs McLean and Post. My name is Brian Latta. I'm part of the consortium and the Council of Governments, and I am the city manager for the city of Harrisburg, Oregon, one of those small rural communities which is oftentimes hindered from development opportunities and economic development opportunities because of wetlands. I'm just going to not repeat testimony that that Pat and Phil have given, but just kind of describe. You know, we are ready. We're ready to move forward. You might ask, why do we need to appropriate money for this project if, as Pat said, we've already done it? Well, we did that work 10 years ago. It's a little old, a little outdated. We need to dust off the plan. We need to reevaluate it and consider the current state of affairs. So there's a need, but I think what that demonstrates is we're ready, we're committed, we've done this work, we can do it again. You know, we have different leadership in place, and we really feel with the state support, we're going to get across the finish line and actually make this happen. The benefits that the legislature receives from having this program be funded for the Dash 4 amendment is we're going to be able to create a replicable program that can be used in other regions of the state. A lot of the regions around the state suffer with the same wetland issues that our Council of Governments area does, our three-county area, and they need, you know, some assistance. And to be able to go through this process in developing a good plan, a business model, and strategies for how to implement a public wetland mitigation bank is going to be useful for a lot of areas of the state. And so we really feel that getting your support in passing the amendment number 4 is going to be critical, not only for our success, but for success throughout the state, and really bringing good economic opportunities, good housing opportunities to realization that just aren't there. I spoke before on Tuesday to the same committee about our housing projects that just don't get built because the market is not strong enough to be able to support housing projects that need to mitigate for wetlands. And it doesn't make sense for us to expand our UGB. We have already done that. We have 90 acres of new residential land, which is also encumbered with wetlands. Harrisburg, if you've been through us, is very flat. We're along the banks of the Willamette River. Anywhere we go, we're going to hit wetlands when we expand. And so we don't want to drive up our development costs and our infrastructure costs and having a piecemeal development of a city that just doesn't make sense. We want to be in compliance with the state land use laws, which, you know, encourage compact form and good development within our urban growth boundaries. That's what this bill enables us to be able to do. So I'm going to stop there and just say please support Amendment Number 4, Amendment Number 2, and others. It's been great working on the committee and the subwork group, and we look forward to the success of this bill.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for our panel?
I have one.
Yes, please, Representative Helm.
I'm really, at this point, sorry that I didn't get to stick my nose into this earlier, because I had too many other things to do, and it sounds really interesting. This is going to be a naive question, but as you went through and as you've done this over the number of years and looked for those funding sources, how do foundations fit in, and why or why not would they be a source of revenue that might be interested in having and managing a wetlands mitigation bank themselves?
So I'll go ahead and tackle that one, and feel free to support me on that. You know, foundations like to see, any lending institution does, a good return on their investment right away. And with wetland mitigation banking, that's not always the case, and it's difficult to do. One of the things that we're really excited about with a public bank and using, you know, some state dollars to help that, as well as our local dollars, we're able to kind of hold on to that financing when the market's maybe down, and it's easier for us to develop a wetland, maybe cheaper for us to develop wetlands at that time. And so, you know, I don't know if we've approached foundations in the past. I'm relatively new to the consortium, but, you know, I don't know if we've approached those institutions before or not, but I can see that would probably be some of their concerns is, you know, hey, are we going to put, you know, a couple $100,000 or, you know, more into a project that may take, you know, 5 or 10 years to actually see it realized.
Did you want to answer?
Yeah. Excuse me. Thank you, Vice Chair McLean and Representative Helm. There actually was some associations involved back in 2010 with helping with the studies with this. I think there was always a question of how the structure with them was going to work. You know, with our cities, we give stability, like I said, and really, Adair Village doesn't give it any stability. The consortium gives it stability because you've got several different organizations. And that's why I use other, like Eugene is a great model. Eugene built their wetlands. They did it. They didn't need any state dollars, so Amendment 2 helped. Our consortium doesn't have that ability. The small rural communities, like we were talking, doesn't have that ability because we can't afford it. And so at the time, I think it was just, you know, who from this committee is going to represent with those organizations. And I was only there for a piece of it, and I just remembered it didn't, they never got that in the model. I just remember that. And there is some language to that in some of the paperwork we have, but it is a large chunk of money that we're looking at, not a couple hundred thousand. And you're talking about a 5 to 10 year return on this. So it's that organizational piece. And I think that's definitely an avenue to look at while we're doing our study. I think that study could definitely look at some, you know, organization and association help.
Thank you.
Yep.
Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. The third panel that we have here, I'd like to call up Susan Morgan, and I'd also like to call up Peggy Lynch and Aaron Doyle. And as Susan's coming up, we're going to start with her, and she was looking at the Dash 3 amendment that's just been posted recently and other items, I'm sure. And so welcome, and please have you start the panel.
Thank you, Vice Chair McLean and Vice Chair Post. Thank you for having me here today. For the record, I'm Susan Morgan. I support the Association of Oregon Counties and put on the record that the Association of Oregon Counties supports the Dash 2 and the Dash 4 amendments. When we talked about HB 2436, the Dash 1s on Tuesday, the 404 partial assumption was the focus, and rightly so. The bill we're talking about today, 2438, offers some more tools in the toolbox, and you've heard about a few of those tools so far. The Dash 3 amendments grew out of the work group conversations. In large parts of the state, the cost of credits is prohibitive, and it's not uncommon to have the cost of wetland credits outstrip the value of the land that you're putting them on. It's often hard to find credits that are available and when they're needed. Much of the undeveloped land inside of urban growth boundaries, as you've heard, has wetlands issues, and all of this impedes the development of good projects like affordable housing. So the question that was posed in the work group, is there a way to make more credits available? And you've heard a few of the tools that may get us there. Pat had a great description of how the housing market and the development market kind of rises and falls like a sine wave. The wetland mitigation market follows that sine wave, and the cost of land that can be used to develop the credit rises and falls on that same kind of wave. The work group had discussions with several private wetland bank owners, as Dave was talking about, and developers who gave us a glimpse into the world. One of the issues that they have that slows down the development of mitigation credits is the cost of carrying the debt incurred in developing a mitigation site while they're waiting for credit sales. If they can't sell them right then they have to somehow service that loan while waiting for the market to heat up again. It's also, as Dave outlined, tough to find banks that will finance wetlands projects. If there was a way to develop a mechanism that could buy credits from private wetland developers or any wetland developers as they became ready, hold them, and then sell them as needed at some predetermined price that would have them available on a consistent basis, it would help cut the tops and the bottoms off of those sine waves. The wetland developers would have more certainty that they could consistently sell credits, so presenting a business case for financing would be more straightforward. Having a consistent place to sell the credits would help them build a stronger business case case for financing the land acquisitions and the wetlands development costs. It's worth having a dialogue about trying to come up with innovative ways to incentivize wetlands developers to continue developing credits, no matter what the overall economy is doing, and develop some way to make those credits available in a consistent and sufficient supply to enable development of things like affordable housing and economic development projects as those opportunities arise. It may also have the added benefit of helping stabilize the cost of those credits. The draft threes that came out today, and as Laura said, it's a lengthy document of 19 pages. I can confess that I have not slogged my way to the end of it yet. But the draft threes are a straw man for that discussion. The concept is being called the Oregon Mitigation Authority. It's structured as a public corporation. It includes both a financing function and some broad language about a planning function and the need to develop criteria for which service areas and banks to buy credits from and which service areas and developers to sell to. A locally driven advisory group is also included, and the draft threes are hot off the presses. This concept is not ready for legislation just yet. In discussing this with Eric Metz and with Rep. McLean, the recommendation is to impanel a work group for this interim and use the dash threes as a straw man to continue to flesh out this concept. It needs to be vetted and worked with the stakeholders, the wetland developers, and the building development community. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I certainly look forward to continuing this discussion.
Thank you so much. Peggy Lynch.
Aaron and I were fighting. Vice Chair McLean, Vice Chair Post, and members of the committee, I am here in support of the dash twos and the dash fours, as I promised on Tuesday. This work from the work group, I am very encouraged about. In particular, I will address the dash fours and specifically. In the first place, you have heard from the previous panel, the regional consortium is ready to go. They have done much of the work. They just need a little bit more to push them over the edge to get this work finished. They are going to create a pilot project that provides the rest of the state an opportunity to learn from them and to perhaps move this kind of a project forward in the future. They also, and this is really important and why I'm supportive of the funding in this case. You heard they have 19 industrial sites. Those are 19 jobs sites that should they be successful in working this program and having the wetlands resolved, the wetlands issues resolved, we will have jobs. Those people pay taxes. We will get revenue from those taxes, which will pay back, I am sure, in great respect, the money, the limited money that probably will be in this bill related to the consortium's work. So I certainly encourage that. I want to also mention the Section 2 related to the mapping. This is actually the project that started this whole work group. You all discovered that there were that the maps were not clear, that local governments and developers needed more guidance in order to know where there might be wetlands, not guaranteed, but might be, in which case, with this new mapping, DSL is going to need an additional assistance in staffing to deal with the notices, the land use notices that they are going to get from local governments and development community. So it is important that we support that effort and move this forward to address the original issue that came before the wetlands work group. I just want to remind you all that wetlands help us have clean water, and they deal with flooding. You have seen the disasters in Nebraska. So it's not as if wetlands don't have a purpose. They have a very real purpose. And with climate change and the new flooding events that have occurred, we know that we have to do this thoughtfully. And that's why it's really important that the removal fill program move forward. The consortium can help us address some of the issues around wetlands while still making sure that we have those jobs. And I just want to make a couple of other quick comments. One is land use planning, as Mr. Honeycutt said, is more than just about housing and development. It also includes goals on natural hazards and other environmental issues. So our land use planning program is a broad program and addresses a number of issues. And lastly, to Representative Helms' comment about foundations, one of the things I have not heard mentioned is that wetlands banks have to stay as wetlands banks. They have to continue to be monitored and approved so that they can continue to exist as that, as the function for that bank. And so there is an expense year after year, and you will hear this, we heard this from the development community, wetlands bank community. It's not just buying the land and doing it once. Year after year, they have to make sure that these banks continue to do the function for which they are being created. And so that's one of the other problems. I'm guessing that if I were a foundation, I would not necessarily want to take on the obligation of continuing that that work alongside it. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to support this bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Vice Chair McLean. Vice Chair Post, members of the committee, Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I was happy to sign up at the bottom so that I can make all the smart people talk first. And Peggy and I were actually arguing over, no, you go, no, you go. We're here to state on the record the League's support of the Dash 2s and 4s. We think that the communities that are represented by the COG have really worked hard. And this is an example of how when the cities and counties and state all work together, we can come up with some really good solutions. Partnering your investment in our local solutions is really the methodology we see will be a solution for a lot of the problems that the state is facing. We also believe that this is going to address some pretty significant goals that are shared between the state and local governments of economic development and housing development. We've looked in a lot of committees about the cost of housing and how we can drive the prices down. And I think if we can find a way to reduce the types of expenses that developers have to incur in order just to start building, that will help drive down housing prices and increase affordability. And for those reasons and just the hard work that our folks that sit in the Cascades West Council of Government have put towards trying to find solutions in their areas, we're very supportive of both the appropriations that we will hopefully find and this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for our panel? Thank you, ladies. Appreciate it. At this time, if there is no one else who wants to speak on our first, excuse me. Hello, Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add, you know, as part of working with you through this process and all of the individuals that were involved in this work group, and I'm very proud of all of your work and thankful for all of your efforts. And I appreciate all of your leadership in the process. And of course, Laura's amazing work and skills during this whole process. And so we'll be getting more accolades as we go through the rest of the bills as well. But thank you.
Thank you very much. So at this time, I'm going to close the public hearing on our first bill. And that was House Bill 2438. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2796. And our staff will give us just a brief description. Thank you, Laura.
Chair McLean, members of the committee, House Bill 2796 would require the Department of State Lands to develop rules to allow removal and fill of degraded wetlands for needed housing projects by general permit or authorization by January 1st of 2021. The bill specifies the permit or authorization cannot require compensatory mitigation at a ratio greater than 1 acre of restored wetlands per 4 acres of impacted degraded wetlands. And there are a few items on OLIS posted.
Okay. All right, at this time then, I believe we have Dave Honeycutt. Were you on for this one? And also we have Nick Voralski, yes.
Okay, if you two like to come up, and then we'll have a second panel.
Thank you, Chair McLean.
I just want to make sure that before you start, we've had so many bills come out of our work group. Now, this is a bill that is sponsored by someone else. It's not our work group. Yeah, and I'm sure you'll start it with that. Not that I'm not claiming it. I'm just saying we want to be very clear that this isn't something that Laura worked on. There are other people out there working, right? Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Chair McLean, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Property Owners Association here, excuse me, in support of House Bill 2796. This, and sitting to my left is Nick Verosky, who is an experienced developer and was really, at least for me, the catalyst of why it is that our organization got started into this entire project, and we're very grateful for all that we've learned and that the subcommittee has done on this issue. But he really is I guess for lack of a better term, he can give you the reasons why we need to do what we're doing with the other two bills. But I want to make clear that with the other bills that we've been talking about, the solutions that are being proposed in those bills are long-term solutions. They're not going to happen overnight. Mr. Verosky's experience with Sheridan, the city of Sheridan, and you'll see a letter on Mr. Verosky's letter on OLIS, along with a letter from the city of Sheridan in support of this bill, his solution is a solution that needs to occur now. And so while we can work on long-term solutions, there are pressing problems that need to be addressed now. And whether it's in the form of this bill or something else, we need to get solutions and we need to get them on the table now. The only other thing I'll say, and then we can hear from the expert on this particular problem, is that while this has been extremely frustrating, we have worked closely with DSL on trying to find a solution for Mr. Verosky and other folks in that situation, people that need to develop now. And they have been extremely helpful. We haven't been able to get there, but our frustration with this issue is not a frustration with DSL. They've tried hard, we've tried hard. I think there's a solution out there, and I'm hoping that we can get that done this session so that projects like Mr. Verosky's can actually move forward and cities like the city of Sheridan can benefit from the development that they desperately need.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sir.
Vice Chairs McLean and Post and committee, thank you for addressing this issue and letting me speak.
Your name for the record.
My name is Nick Verosky, and I have developed a workforce housing project in Sheridan, among other areas in Beaverton. Since the EPA adopted their definition of a wetland in the 1970s, the term has expanded without regard to the economic costs of the human habitat. In the 1970s, land was relatively plentiful and inexpensive, and technologies may not have existed to adequately clean water runoff before it entered fish habitat. Thus, reliance on water percolation through the soil was important. Now, however, the application of decades-old rules and thinking in the face of today's technologies, population, housing needs, and land costs is taking a real human economic toll. Changes are warranted. The plight of Sheridan in Yamhill County is an excellent example of the economic tragedy being exacted upon a community. I've owned nearly 12 acres of residential land inside the city limits of Sheridan since 1997. In 2015, Forest River, Inc., a Berkshire Hathaway subsidiary, working with the government's Governor's Department of Regional Solutions and Business Oregon, purchased a defunct mobile home manufacturing facility in Sheridan for renovation and announced they would hire up to 250 employees to manufacture RV trailers. At that time, no new housing existed, was being built in Sheridan, and none has been built since. In April 2016, I began my efforts to develop a manufactured housing park consistent with zoning and housing need, a park I named Fox Hollow. The objectives of my development were and are, one, to provide a single family detached living environment to Sheridan's growing manufacturing workforce earning an estimated $47,500 annually. Two, provide at least some single family detached housing for families earning as little as $35,000, slightly more than the statewide average of $33,000 for agricultural workers. And number three, provide an entry-level housing option where first-time home buyers could start to build equity in a single-family detached home in an attractive, well-maintained, and well-managed community. These project goals are consistent with Governor Brown's 2018 housing policy agenda to expand housing supply to rural communities. My efforts were brought to a halt in June 2016, however. The reason, since purchasing my land and developing a 60-lot workforce housing subdivision on the southerly 10 acres, the slow movement of water across my flat ground, lack of annual cultivation of the land apparently turned the soils hydric. The state calls this a wetland, although there is no standing water, nor pond, nor wildlife habitat. The soil type exists in nearly all of Sheridan's lands, both residential and employment lands, on its west side, destroying feasible development of those lands, making the lands virtually worthless, and harming the community's ability to create both housing and jobs. My conversations with Forest River, Business Oregon, Regional Solutions, and city officials indicated that Sheridan would need at least 125 to 150 new homes selling in the $150,000 range just to accommodate the Forest River job growth. New residents would positively impact the local Sheridan economy with about $3.5 million of annual disposable income and health care benefit spending. Struggling downtown Sheridan businesses would have a new infusion of life. The Sheridan school system that is operating under capacity could see a resurgence of students, activities, and state funding, in addition to a fresh energy of new parents volunteering in the schools. Land that is generating only a few thousand dollars in property taxes could be generating hundreds of thousands. In fact, I estimate property taxes from my land alone that are currently would rise from $1,800 a year to $184,000. A hundredfold increase. Early in my efforts, I was told that Governor Brown considered Sheridan a community at risk. Census data from the 2010 and 2015 updates shows some compelling and worrisome facts. Sheridan median household income is only $37,000, 66% of the state average of $56,000, and 21% less than the projected manufacturing workforce wages. Sheridan's median per capita income is only $14,500, 50% of the U.S. average of $28,900. Sheridan's population in poverty is 19.4%, 44% more than the U.S. average of 13.5%. Its population under age 65 without health insurance is 20.7%, double the U.S. average of 10.5%. Retail sales in Sheridan are under $62,000 per thousand of $62 per $1,000 of household income, 25% of the national average. Sheridan, downtown Sheridan realtors, retailers are barely surviving, if at all. City Manager Frank Sheridan reports the lack of new housing prohibits new families located in Sheridan, which in turn is causing a decline in student population, which in turn is causing a decline in school funding, which in turn further discourages new families from moving into Sheridan. An exclamation point is added to all the above by Sheridan's westerly census tract, earning the dubious status of State Regional Solutions and Business Oregon as an opportunity zone, a definition and program created by Congress, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 to encourage long-term investments in low-income rural and urban communities nationwide. The U.S. Federal Reserve Board has determined that homeowners have an average of net worth of $195,000 more than renters at age 65. However, two facts stand out in Sheridan. Wealth through real estate appreciation is not occurring because the community is not flourishing. And two, absent the application of a logical approach to wetland mitigation in Oregon, Sheridan has no clear path to prosperity. Therefore, conditions I listed above are only likely to get worse. In November 2016, I met with officials of the Department of State Lands. Their comments included, one, renovate my drain tiles, then in 10 years, the soil would have dried out and I could develop. Two, pay $705,000 to the Mud Slough Mitigation Bank, upon which DSL would issue a permit allowing me to develop my property now. Both strategies ultimately recognize that the wetlands in my soils really have no long-term value. The current laws simply exact a cost against the land that make development infeasible. To be specific on this, my analysis of construction costs, buyer affordability, park operating expenses, and financing feasibility without the $705,000 mitigation fee shows that homeowners would pay between 33 and 37% of their household income in housing costs. This is slightly over the 30% of income level ratio that Oregon calls stressed, although it's still under the 43% ratio that FHA financing allows. Even then, my own return on investment of nearly $4.4 million would be in the range of 2 to 3% once the park is filled. That's a return that does not logically offset the risk. Therefore, my property sits empty, as do many commercial properties in downtown Sheridan. My land will continue to sit empty until feasible development can occur. The losers are workers forced to commute on Highway 18 between their jobs in Sheridan and homes in their homes in other cities. The environment, as their commutes needlessly consume fossil fuels, pollute the air, and spew brake dust, not to mention the risk associated with travel on crowded Highway 18. The workers, again, is with their vehicles depreciating more rapidly as they rack up miles more quickly, a real cost the IRS estimates at 58 cents a mile, or about $400 per month for their round trips between Sheridan and McMinnville. Families and children whose working parents must spend time commuting rather than parenting and bonding with their children. The Sheridan school system, which is losing students as families are forced to live in other communities, resulting in loss of funding and education quality, plus the loss of parental involvement in their children's school programs and activities such as sports coaching and leadership development. Community services funding from vacant land property taxes versus built out land taxes. Property owners like me, who bought their lands years ago as part of a retirement strategy, now to find their land basically worthless. Downtown commercial property owners whose businesses or tenants struggle for lack of patrons. Employers who can't find workers because the workers who prefer to live near their place of employment can't find housing. In fact, the city of Sheridan was stymied for several months in their efforts to find a new public works director because candidates could not find housing within the city. Ultimately, the entire populace of Sheridan loses as property values deteriorate under the weight of all the above. This is a fact shown by the U.S. Census, showing the median value of an owner-occupied home is only $147,000. Who are the winners? I don't know. Certainly not the environment, due to the costs noted above. Certainly not the mitigation banks. The cost burdens imposed by them makes rural development of affordable and workforce housing infeasible. Thus, the mitigation credits don't get purchased. Certainly not Oregon taxpayers, who in the last biennium funded Oregon Housing and Community Services with $1.2 billion to help its lower income citizens find affordable housing. Housing that simply does not exist. And certainly not new residents who come to Oregon only to find the lack of housing supply has driven the median price of homes to north of $450,000. ACOSTA requires annual incomes of between $80,000 and $115,000 just to afford to buy a home for their families. Stated another way, it would take 3 to 4 agricultural families pooling their resources to buy one median-priced home in Oregon. It would take 2 to 3 manufacturing workers pooling their resources to buy a median-priced home. Even in McMinnville, as of March 12th, there were only 48 homes priced under $450,000, with the least expensive home in the entire city priced at nearly $200,000. I urge the committee and the state legislature to pass this bill and encourage that this needed housing project and others can proceed, helping save at-risk communities such as Sheridan and helping to make a contribution to the governor's goal to increase the supply of rural and affordable and workforce housing in Oregon. I should point out that, Metro trying to address this problem recently passed a $650 million bond to address affordable housing. I've already mentioned the budget for Oregon Housing and Community Services. I'm not asking at this time for any of those monies. All I'm asking for is a logical, rational approach to development on marginal wetlands in Oregon. Thank you for your time and interest in producing and pursuing at least one solution to this very serious crisis affecting Oregon's communities.
Thank you very much. Any questions for our panel? I appreciate your comments today. Thank you. Our last panel on this is going to be Peggy Lynch, Ellen Miller, and Aaron Doyle. And this is a very balanced panel. We have one for, one against, and one neutral.
So. I said what I said about Ellen, finding she was coming back.
She said today.
Not one issue.
Say the last time.
I was listening.
She's still here.
Aaron, go first this time.
What, me?
Yeah, you. Because you're neutral.
Robustly neutral. Vice Chair McLean, Vice Chair Post, members of the committee, Aaron Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. We want to see success in the development of housing and a reduction in the barriers that it takes to get there, but we are a little bit concerned about some ramifications that are perhaps outside the scope of what DSL will be able to take into consideration, particularly issues related to the National Flood Insurance Program and development risk when we put things in areas that may or may not be subject to water coming in. We need to be able to maintain our participation in that program, and we want to be sure that we are properly defining each of these terms so that we're not putting ourselves at risk. And every year, the National Flood Insurance Program tries to create more and more reasons why not to build anywhere near possibility of water ever being somewhere, and we just don't want to run afoul of that. In addition, I would just point out that needed housing is defined in 197.303 as all housing. It's not just specific to middle and lower income housing or particular housing types. Eventually, you get to every house as needed housing. We are happy to work with the proponents to try and find a solution. We would love it if DSL could find an administrative solution so we didn't have to make robust legislative changes to address these particular issues. But we do foresee this as a possible issue beyond Sheridan. And therefore, we need to find some sort of solution. I'm just not sure that we've found it completely here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ellen?
Chair McLean, Vice Chair Post, members of the committee, Ellen Miller here representing the Oregon Home Builders Association. This is the last time I will be in front of you speaking on a bill this session. The Oregon Home Builders is here in support of House Bill 2796, although the impetus of this bill really was the Sheridan issue, and I thank Mr. Verosky for really explaining that in a very detailed level, what happened in that instance. The bill is really written in more of a statewide form, and we feel that it really is a statewide issue. So thank you for holding the hearing on the bill and for having this discussion. We think it is really important. We do understand that there are some details that need to be ironed out, but we really commend you for having this conversation today and appreciate your support. Thanks.
And Peggy.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. I get to oppose this bill, and I was on a roll.
seriously, I want to thank the developer for his explanation of housing issues and for his story about Sheridan. It was a complete and very clear story of the issues that we're having around the state related to figuring out how to deal with housing issues. I would note a couple of things. One is the governor has a regional accelerator with House Bills 2055 and 2056 that I would commend you to. I don't know if this project would fit with those. It did with the city of Donald when they had not a dissimilar issue where the employer as well as a private entity then worked together to provide workforce housing in that area for their expansion. And then I want to share a couple of other things that we've talked about before. It's really important that we keep important wetlands. And so as a part of our work, we have worked with the Department of Land Conservation and Development as they are continuing their urban growth boundary streamlining rulemaking that they have done to recognize the issues that I have heard constantly about the fact that we tell people they should build on lands and then tell them, no, you can't. And so we have to address that issue. We have to say that if these are wetlands that need to be protected, then we need not to count them as part of the buildable lands inventory. And unlike others who I know are concerned about expansion of UGBs onto farmland and et cetera, and certainly that's something we care about, I also think it's fair to say what's buildable and what isn't. So we are more than willing to work on this issue to try to address that broader issue. And again, I want to thank the developer for his great story about the things that can happen unless we can find some solutions to this. Thank you. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Representative Williams.
So, Peggy, I agree with you with regard to the conflict between buildable land, but it's not really buildable. And I'm wondering if you're aware of any map that would or project where we have or maybe Representative Helm, I know this is something you paid attention to as well, where are we overlapping or we're saying in one context this is wetland that needs to be protected and in another context as part of the buildable land survey. Ellen, maybe you, I don't know.
Let me start.
Do we have
I think I'll start. We in this committee last time we had a particular issue in the Eugene area where somebody had gotten approval from a county process and then was told by a state process that they couldn't rebuild when they'd had a fire. Okay. And so that brought some of this up in front of this committee and Chair Clem. And so I think there have been some issues. And when we were talking about mapping and we were talking about simplifying processes and things like that, we were trying to address the fact, as Peggy pointed out, that we want to be fair, equitable, and make sure that everybody, you know, is looking at the same story or the same map or the same consequences for building or not building on a piece of property. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where the committee's been for those that have been gone for a year or two. And I'd be happy to have any of you add to that.
So, Chair McLean, Representative Williams, so part of the issue is the fact that the state has not helped local governments do good Goal 5 work that would actually identify some of those areas that really need to be saved. Some communities have better Goal 5 mapping than others. But that's part of the issue. And so when they don't have good, well-designated Goal 5 maps, it's easier, well, it's frankly, they are required to say this land is supposed to have 5 units, 10 units, 15 units to the acre, in spite of the fact that the truth is it's really probably a wetlands that would not be allowed.
That's why you saw the previous bill on mapping.
Yes.
You know, that was where we
were
trying to get
to that. That would help address that moving forward. So, and I have a follow-up on that one for your Aaron.
Vice Chair McLean, Representative Williams, I think this is indicative of when we try to do comprehensive planning, we are trying to be comprehensive, but and this is where we need resources from the state to help drill down on some of this. I'll also say that this type of issue is further complicated by the regulatory structure, having all layers of government weighing in with very different standards. And so when I talk about the National Flood Insurance Program, we have been, with the state support, working hard to prevent some really onerous, difficult regulations that the federal government is trying to enact related to floodplain development. So one of the things that I think that the Goal 5 conversation that happens on and off as we've looked at what is and isn't working in our land use system, what goals need better support, what goals need more clarification, is that even when we think we have those rules right, someone else changes the rules, changes the definition, and that requires a remapping. So it's not the same, but the flood insurance maps get remapped at a schedule set by the feds, done work by the state, and sometimes take the entire developable land out of the development picture. Wetlands being redefined, wetlands being better understood from a scientific standpoint can't have those types of impacts. And so the mapping projects are really important, and to do them at the local level is vital, but expensive.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to allow two more questions, and then we've got one work session, and I'm supposed to be in Portland for our state budget night out.
To listen to the revenue that we need.
Yeah. So any other questions for our panel? I'm happy to take at least two more.
I just have one.
Okay, sure.
I'm sorry. This bill says with no more, that we can't mandate any more than a 1-to-4 replacement ratio. I'm wondering why that's sufficient if we're going to get rid of 4 acres of wetland, that it's okay to replace it with only 1, if there's some science behind that, or what's the...
Well,
hey, Mr. Honeycutt's answer.
Okay, and you can email me that answer if you want to, just so that we can move on. I'm just curious about that. I'm guessing there's a reason for that number.
There's also material on OLIS, and there's other issues, and there's federal level issues. So it's important for you to maybe look at that and then
get
the information.
Thanks.
Yes, and please, here's our last question. Our comment.
It's a comment, and I just want to thank everybody for all the work. It's really encouraging to see the legislature sink its teeth into this, because it's really needed. And I just wanted to observe, in your own district, you have an excellent example of how wetlands not only can cohabitate with a community, this is Jackson Bottom, but act as a community amenity. And just as a general statement, you don't get a Jackson Bottom out of a 10-acre wet piece of ground. That takes much more effort and institutional oomph. And my guess is that that's a lot more, Jackson Bottom is a lot more of what we want to support fish and wildlife than little kind of crummy wetlands here, there, and everywhere. And so I would applaud any efforts to go in that direction, and I thank everyone for this work.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay, I believe we've reached the end of folks on the this particular bill. So I'm going to close the House Bill 2796 public hearing. And we have a choice. We have a work session next. And so I'd like us to vote on that, if everybody's comfortable with that. Is everybody comfortable with that? Did you want to say something? Would you like to? Yeah, let's have Laura say something first.
Chair McLean, members of the committee, just a brief reminder, House Bill 2137 would extend the sunset on tax credits for agriculture workforce housing owners and operators from January 1st of 2020 to January 1st of 2026. There is a -1 amendment on OLIS, which does the same thing, and in addition, it creates a state income tax credit for the operational costs of that agriculture workforce housing, including costs for insurance, property management, repair, maintenance, resident services, et cetera. It also establishes other requirements in the -1. There is revenue and fiscal paperwork on OLIS and the bill's subsequent referrals to House Revenue, where they would enhance their fiscal or their revenue light into a full revenue.
Okay. Vice Chair McLean, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated February 28th, 2019.
Representative Post moves to adopt the -1 amendments dated February 28th, 2019. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, is there any objection on the motion to adopt the dash one amendments? Seeing none, the motion carries and the amendments are adopted.
Vice Chair McLean, I move HB 2137 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Post has moved House Bill 2137 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Yes, please, one Representative quick, Post.
One quick word. I think because she's watching, she was here when we had testimony on this public hearing. Molly Paramine McCarter, she's one of my constituents out in St. Paul, and she's put a lot into this, so I wanted to thank her publicly for what she does on her farm, the housing and the extra things that she does that's far and above, you know, what is needed, or you know what I mean, or necessary. I mean, she does more. So I appreciate her coming in that day that she came here and didn't get a chance to say that to her.
Right. Anybody else? Okay, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. Okay, at this time then we have finished the agenda for today. And is there anything for the good of the order? Seeing nothing, we are going to close the meeting for March 21st, the first day of spring. Thank you.